This is a service of Central Michigan University School of Broadcast and Cinematic Arts.
WMHW, HD1 and HD2 Mount Pleasant. Modern Rock 91.5. Where music begins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Ethics Talk. The team is honored to be joined by special guest host, Dr. Adam Epstein. Dr. Epstein is a former sports agent turned professor. I don't know if that was the plan or not, but now he teaches sports law, contract law, and do you have another class?
This semester, sports law and contract law, that's it. I teach business law in the summer.
Okay. But
now you were a student of mine, weren't you?
Yeah, that's a call your classes. Not because I liked you, just because I had no choice. I think I took two of them.
How'd you do?
I think I got A's, maybe a B+. I'm not sure.
Okay. I'll have to check when we're through.
Okay, and you're talking about starting a special topic class in the NCAA, right? Maybe just mulling it over?
Well, I just thought of that about the last 5 minutes. So if you define talking as within the last 5 minutes, then absolutely, yes.
All right. Well, it's very fortuitous because today's show is on the NCAA.
And obviously it's a comedy show.
Right. I mean, it's our stand-up routine. Didn't even practice it or anything. So obviously on the eve of March Madness, maybe we're a little bit late, but we'd like to talk about the NCAA. Not necessarily the March Madness tournament, but I think it'll come up when we get into the nitty-gritty details. So for those of our listeners who aren't familiar or maybe are familiar but want to brush up, can you just give me an overview? What is the NCAA? I mean, what does it do? How is it formed? What are its duties?
Oh, okay. Well, we only have 49 minutes or so, 50 minutes. basically, the NCAA is the largest amateur sports organization in the United States, possibly the world. It is a private, voluntary, tax-exempt or nonprofit 501c3 organization that's based out of Indianapolis, Indiana. It was formed in 1906 because back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, the sport of football was causing injury and death. Especially in the Northeast. And President Teddy Roosevelt called the college presidents to Washington and said, look, we're going to have to change the rules of football because people are dying while they're playing the sport of football. So the history of the NCAA really goes back to the early 1900s. 1906 is when it became official, and it was because of the sport of football and people dying. Now, the reason why they were dying was because of things like the flying wedge, which was this formation where the football players would sort of form a rugby scrum and literally just charge at each other. There were 18 deaths over in 1 year for, as a matter of fact. So the NCAA was formed primarily for safety reasons. As it evolved over time into the 20s, 30s, 40s, they decided as interest in college sports grew, and obviously the advent of radio and television, and we weathered the storm of the Great Depression. More people got interested in college sports, particularly after the World Wars. They decided to come up with a code called the Sanity Code. So that was sort of like the next major phase in the NCAA. Originally safety, and then it evolved into this sanity phase where they developed rules for things like how much financial aid could you give a student athlete, and how many scholarships can we offer, what sports will we offer, and so sort of to bring it out of chaos some sort of measure of sanity. And in fact, the NCAA rule book was called the Sanity Code. Then as time marched on, the NCAA, as it grew slowly but surely, still a nonprofit organization, they decided that they had to enforce some of the rules that they claimed to want to enforce. And there was this decade or several decades of enforcement where schools, particularly in the sport of basketball, were involved in incidents involving sports point shaving. University of Kentucky, believe it or not, all of their tradition in their sport of basketball, they were found to have been involved in a sports bribery incident or two with their sport of basketball. So it went from safety to sanity to enforcement. And then once you got into the 1970s and 80s, particularly with color television and standards of living grew, you got into an era where the NCAA wanted to truthfully maximize its revenues. In other words, expand its horizons, be on national television as frequently as possible. And there were several lawsuits that were involved, which helped shape the television landscape of today, where there's a virtually unlimited amount of times that you can be on television. But at one point in time, the NCAA told schools, this was in the late 1970s and 80s, that you could only be on national television once or twice a year, so that the bigger schools wouldn't get an advantage. And that case actually went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that you cannot control it. You know, violated antitrust law. You cannot control the amount of times that you can appear on television, and hence now we have the system we have today. After the maximization of revenues, I shouldn't really say after, because that still goes on today, as I'm sure you know. The NCAA in the late 1990s and in 2000s really has established a social agenda where, for whatever reason, they've taken it upon themselves, and I'm not faulting them for this per se, but they've decided that school nicknames and mascots are at the forefront of their concern, and the NCAA has a position now that if your school continues to have a Native American Indian mascot or logo or nickname without the consent of, the constituents, that they won't hold championships in your state, as you won't be able to participate in their postseason championships. So it's really evolved. It's probably a lot longer answer than you were looking for, Michael, but the idea is that it's evolved from an organization that was designed to protect football players from death to an organization which, as you know today, has a television contract worth, now let's get this straight, 14 years. They just signed a 14-year, $10.8 billion, with a B, billion-dollar television contract with CBS. And as one more thing, most of the revenue for the NCAA comes from this March Madness tournament, which is going on right now. All How's right. that?
Good. I have a lot of questions. I actually forgot some of that material, believe it or not. I don't have a photographic memory. Mnemonic memory.
Where are your PowerPoints when you need them?
Yeah,
right?
I know. I didn't bring them. I'm a failure. But
what's
yeah.
your comedy show?
That was like 2 months of class right there. So if you're thinking about taking sports law, check out that blurb just given by...
Yeah, BLR 337.
Yeah, that's it right there. So I have a couple of questions. I'll see if I can address them chronologically. I might fail. This word amateur, you use this word, the NCAA was an organization designed for amateur athletes. I think that's what you said. Now, I know from class and from a few other places that this word amateur is very, very important. Can you give me some of the connotations that are, included in the word amateur? What does it mean to be an amateur?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Did I say amateur today, or was that from class?
No, you said it today.
I did, really? Okay, excellent. Well, amateur is one of my favorite words to talk about in sports law class, because it comes from the Latin, of course, amo, which means I love, amo, amare, to love. An amateur is someone who does something for the love of the sport. And if you look at the NCAA manual, its bylaws, those are the rules of the NCAA, 434 pages, by the way, I checked before I came over here. The original bylaws were, I think, 25 pages. Now it's 434 and growing every year. But the NCAA says that only amateur athletes can participate in NCAA sports. But there are exceptions, okay? Because the NCAA says an amateur is someone who participates merely as, and this is the word of the day, an avocation. Do you know what an avocation is?
I don't. The word commitment, something like
that? That was on the exam.
I'm sorry. I'm sure I got it right.
It does involve a commitment. An avocation. What's a vocation?
Well, a vocation. I don't know. Tell me.
All right. Well, I was going to ask you what a vacation is, too, but an avocation is supposedly something you do as a hobby. In other words, it's not supposed
not
to be...
Not a job.
And not a job.
Can I just say, if I may, right. interject something in here, is that... And other shows, we've talked about this concept called doing something for its own sake or intrinsic motivation. And so an amateur or an avocation is somebody who's doing something for its own sake, whereas when we talk about a vocation, you have a job for the sake of money. And so therefore, you're doing you love the activity.
All right, excellent. Really cool. Yeah, I mean that's pretty solid. The NCAA's position throughout its manual is that student athletes are amateurs and they participate as a privilege, not as a right, and that their motivation should be primarily motivated by academics. That's why it's student athlete, not athlete student. And that their reason for being on college campuses is for the love of their sport, not as sort of a training ground for professional sports. The problem is, and I say it's a problem, and others agree with me, is that they say there is this clear line of demarcation, and that's their words, mm-hmm. a clear line of demarcation, a line in the sand, if you will, between professional athletes and amateur athletes. And the truth of the matter is, there is no clear line. Right. It's blurry. Mm-hmm. Now, am I saying that you can be a professional basketball player and a amateur at the same time? No. The NCAA actually says you can be a professional athlete in one sport, but you can be an amateur in another. And as we talked about in class, the most common example would be a minor league baseball player. Right. For example, remember when you're in high school, maybe you had a friend or so who was drafted out of high school into major league baseball, and they decided, you know, I'm going to take this signing bonus, I'm going to go in the minor leagues and give it a shot. And then after, more often than not, they're talented in another sport as well, and then they realize at age 21, 22, 23, they're not going to make it to the majors, and they give up their dream, they come back to college, and they're a 24-year-old freshman.
Yep.
Okay. And you say, wait a minute, the NCAA said, you know, participation should be as an avocation or as a hobby, you should be an amateur. Well, the NCAA also says you could be a professional in one sport and an amateur in another. Sure. There's a few other asterisks there. Like, for example, if you sign with an agent, you can actually have an agent in one sport as long as the contract specifically states it's just for that sport. But my point is... and I apologize for rambling on here, but my point is that the amateur says it's all about amateur athletics and amateurism, but it's really not. That line is blurry.
Sure. But the main idea is participants in college sports via the NCAA must be amateurs, right? Not professionals.
That is definitely a driving theme, yes. That is there are exceptions, but amateurism is a driving theme. And the NCAA, of course, has other driving themes as well, but that's a primary one, yeah.
I also just want to say something about, you know, you made a distinction, Dr. Epstein, between student hyphen athlete and athlete hyphen student. And so one could also ask, what do you mean by student? And, you know, it seems that one goes to college for different reasons, and the question, you're not really pushing the question to the limit, you know. Why are you here in college? And so I think this is part of the reason why there is no clear line of demarcation. Because everybody has different underlying motivations. And if that's the real test, then that seems to be like there's almost a subjective element in what a amateur and...
I think it's quite clear that no NCAA official is going to be able to tell you who are the, you know, Michael and Marcus Vicks of the college world that are clearly just using college as a stepping stone to professional sports. And, you know, who is trying to get a degree. You know, you're... Well, I was going to say you're Dan Lefevers, but, you know, that's not going to work, so...
Is there a legal test for what an amateur is? I mean, is there such a... Because if it's so crucial...
Well, that's interesting that you should say that. That has come up from time to time, who is and who isn't an amateur, and really it boils down to one thing. Are you being paid to play? Because if you get paid to play, then you are defined as a professional.
Okay, interesting.
I have a feeling we're going to be coming back to this. I can see it in the works already. It's not on the
outline. Game.
Not scripted or anything.
Well, who is and who isn't an amateur is a philosophical, ethical, and legal question,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just good on the legal side, you know?
Okay. My next question, perhaps you saw this one coming. The NCAA, you said, is a not-for-profit, 501c3, tax-exempt corporation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Not only is it a tax-exempt, but so are the athletic conferences, and so are the, for the most part, all of its membership. They're tax exempt, like Central Michigan University, a nonprofit organization. I mean, under the law,
right.
You know.
I have no issues with that, you know, at first glance. It's what does it fall under, like the educational section? I know what 501c3 can be,
it's
educational,
a tax code.
Scientific, right.
Yeah.
It,
religious.
Educational corporations, religious, scientific. There's actually like six or seven.
You're exactly right. And the key test, I think, is its primary mission for educational, religious, scientific.
That for the sake of which it exists as an entity.
Correct.
So we're thinking like Ronald McDonald House, possibly the Flatlander Society, although I don't know if they quite qualify. You never know.
Well, as you know, I tell people in my class that under the law, you know, you've got Toys for Tots, you've got Salvation Army, you've got Goodwill, you've got the Ronald McDonald House, you've got the Soup Kitchen, and then the NCAA, which has a 14-year, $10.8 billion television contract,
right.
And they're all categorized in the same way under the law, you know?
That seems a little bit, one of these things is not like the other, but we'll see. We'll let our listeners decide for themselves. So how does the NCAA get its funding then? As a charitable organization, I mean, how does it generate revenue? I mean, does it take donations? Does it... Obviously, there's no one ringing a bell at the grocery store like the Salvation Army, but how does it get its money?
Far and away, there's two ways that the NCAA generates revenue, and one is going on right now, and that's the March Madness basketball tournament. Over 90% of the revenues to the organization itself comes from this tournament, okay? Now, it redistributes that money to its member conferences, et cetera, but the other way that the NCAA generates revenue is through its championship tournaments and competitions, meaning whether it's softball, whether it's field hockey, soccer, swimming, whatever. When they sell tickets at these events, it raises some revenue that way as well, including merchandise. But far and away, nothing even comes close. It's the television revenue from this March Madness basketball tournament, which is going on right now.
So the cable companies, CBS.
Yeah, CBS,
NBC,
CBS
the
Sports.
Networks,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. They are paying the NCAA for the
Correct.
Rights to air the game.
Correct.
And then all the commercials, publicity, et cetera, I assume that's just the same sort of ball of money.
Well, the NCAA, you know, my area is the law, so I look at things from the legal aspect, but I do know a little bit about the business side, and there are official sponsors of the NCAA as well. Off the top of my head, I think there's 12. I'm not really sure. And they pay dollars to the NCAA to say we're an official sponsor. But when all is said and done, the money that CBS Sports pays to the NCAA is its primary revenue source. In other words, they call it media rights.
Okay, but this is still for an educational purpose, right?
Well, I don't know if the money... Well, I don't think a CBS executive would say it's for an educational purpose. It's to generate revenue for themselves. But the organization asserts that its primary motivation is educational in nature. I mean, absolutely.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm saying that's what they say.
But 14 years, $10.8 billion, right? That's the number that just keeps repeating over and over again.
I have a question. You said that there are at least, I think, 12 sponsors.
Official sponsors.
What's an example of one?
You know, I think Coca-Cola is one, AT&T, State Farm. If you ever watch a broadcast, it's kind of comical during the... Do you watch football?
No.
Okay.
That's why I'm here.
All right. Well, if you ever happen to... be at someone's house and they have a football game on and you don't want to tell
them. That's happened in my own house. We have football. I just don't really take it seriously.
Okay, well, if somebody grabs you and forces you to watch, you know, like
attention.
A Clockwork Orange or something of that.
Shot me glasses.
Yeah, they're dropping eye drops in your eyes. After an extra point, you often see the State Farm symbol in between the uprights,
right.
And it's the craziest thing. You think, Have we gone that far? Is that amateurism and education at its finest? So.
And typically on a nonprofit, there's a board of directors. Do you know if people from the corporate sponsors serve on the board?
Oh wow, that's getting too technical for me. But I can assure you that the NCAA does operate as a corporation. I mean, it has a board of directors, mm-hmm. a board of governors, mm-hmm. all kinds of bureaucratic committees. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt they do run corporate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, well, they have to.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
On the subject of comical sponsorship representations, I think my favorite is like this is the Goodyear play of the game, you know, or this is
right.
Those always get mm-hmm. me, you know. This is the AT&T replay.
Well, I mean,
what makes it the Goodyear play of the game? That's what I'm always wondering. You know, is there like a board of directors sitting and that's the one we gotta have it?
That's the way it works. I mean, that's capitalism. That's the American way. That's
cheesy.
You know what that is? That's something we really haven't emphasized, and that's money. I mean, that's what money does. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, paint me a picture. You told me that the NCAA redistributes its funds, so it's this not-for-profit organization, which means that it can't report a profit on its income tax returns. It has to get this money.
No, I don't know about
reinvests.
That.
It reinvests the
That's the
revenue.
Actuality of the situation, right? But that's what most organizations do anyway, right? Most corporations
no.
reinvest in themselves.
Well, if you can have a dividend.
Right, but this is rarely the path taken.
I'll try to put
my business background.
Yeah, I'll try to put it in a polite way. A nonprofit organization is one whose interest is for its own members or stakeholders, if you want to call it that, to promote the religious or educational scientific purpose. It's not to generate revenue solely for financial purposes.
Okay.
I.e. shareholders.
Shareholders, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said stakeholders because...
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So as it's redistributing this money to the various member states, mm-hmm. what have you, how does this work? I mean, does CMU, who has 20,000 students, get a certain percentage of the money? Does U of M, who has a winning team, you know, do they get a certain... How does it work? Can you paint me a picture?
You know, it's really interesting. before I agreed to do the show, I did a little research on how the NCAA, what it does with its money. And to be honest with you, they do an excellent job of reporting where the money goes.
Sure.
It's very much transparent, in my opinion, and under the law it has to be. But probably one of the biggest issues I have with the way money is redistributed is it mostly goes to the six largest conferences, and these are known as the BCS conferences, the Bowl Championship Series, of which Central Michigan is not one of those conferences.
Right.
CMU, Central Michigan, is in the Mid-American Conference,
right.
The MAC. Okay, so the NCAA's basketball tournament rewards all the conferences based upon the number of units, which is an interesting way of saying the more times that a team from your conference is in the NCAA basketball tournament, the more money your conference gets. Okay? Now, the MAC only had one team in it this year. Do you know what team that was? Okay.
Bowling Green? I got
Well, Wright State. It was Akron. And Akron won the conference championship. Yeah, I probably shouldn't have put you on the spot like that.
It's okay. I don't watch basketball. I'm not mad about it.
Okay. Well, and so they made one appearance, and they were one and done. That means the MAC gets the Mid-American Conference, which is in Cleveland, gets approximately $1.4 million. Last year, the Atlantic Coast Conference, the ACC, that's like North Carolina, you know, the Florida States, et cetera, $18 million went to that conference. And one of my concerns is if the NCAA is truly serving its members' interests, and I mean all of them, why is one conference getting $17 million more than another?
Sure. Why,
it doesn't seem right, does it? Wouldn't you think that all the members, including CMU, would get the same share of revenue? And that, I mean, if that truly was the purpose of the NCAA to create a level playing field, because right now what it's creating is creating two cultures, the haves and the have-nots, and right. You know where CMU falls.
So what do you think the motivation is for this inequitable distribution of revenue? Or,
well, I think it's to keep the more powerful and larger schools happy. I mean, one way or another, this all comes down to money. You can talk about amateurism all you want, but that March Madness basketball tournament generates 90% or more of the money, and it gets redistributed to the more powerful universities, including schools like Michigan and Michigan State.
I don't necessarily have a problem, you know, with this generation of revenue and redistribution on a basis that it's not totally arbitrary, right? You've pointed that out. They have a system here.
Correct.
It just doesn't seem as though the system is fair. So while it is an objective system, its consequences do not seem to be of the nature of the organization.
You know, that's so funny that you should say that. And Dr. May, you probably will appreciate this one. You know, remember the book Animal Farm?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, right?
No.
The quote that sticks out with me is, you know, mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm going to say? Mm-hmm. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. And that is exactly what you see with the NCAA. And by the way, I should add that I'm talking primarily about the men's March Madness basketball tournament, not the women's. Also, there are three major divisions in the NCAA. There's Division I, which is what Central Michigan is, and then there's Division II. And Division III doesn't offer any scholarships. So there's three actually divisions. They call that a federated structure. So
what's the difference between Division I and Division II?
Primarily the number of scholarships. Okay. I mean, if somebody stopped me on the street and said, what's what you just said, I would say two things. The size of the school.
Number of students.
Yep. Number of students, size of the school, and the number of scholarships is less. So, yeah. Now, Division III is a whole different world. It's probably what most people, let me rephrase that. It's probably what purists would think that the NCAA would be about, where you would truly have student athletes who were not receiving athletics, grants, and aids going to school with the primary motivation to get a college degree.
Do you know what ALMA is, ALMA College down the road?
You know,
Probably not Division I.
No. Okay. It's not Division I. I think it's Division II. Okay. I think it's Division II. Right. Yeah.
Right. We're looking it up after the show.
Well, I should know because Dr. Anthony is an alumnus. You know Tom Anthony?
Yeah.
He's an alumnus. And I think
also
it's Division
II. Also in the
legal
department here at CMU.
Correct.
He teaches business law. I'm not sure. Legal environment and business, something like that.
He does. Now, when you said legal department, you don't mean the in-house. You're talking about
he certainly could be, right? He is an attorney.
Well, he is a practicing attorney, but you're talking about the finance and law department, right?
Right.
Okay, of which he's on the law side,
right,
or the legal side as opposed to the illegal side, which is the finance people, right?
I think he actually does personal estate planning, too. I'm not sure, though.
You know, last time I checked, he has not sponsored this broadcast, so I think we've had enough of Dr. Anthony.
Okay, fair enough. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Dr. Adam Epstein of the CMU Legal Department. Just kidding. Actually, the Law Department here at CMU. Talk about the NCAA. If you're interested, check out our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. We've got some interesting resources. You can catch any part of the show you might have missed, and you'll see upcoming shows, etc. So my next question, we've been talking primarily about March Madness, which, although interesting, you know, I do make a bracket most years. This year I didn't because, I don't know, just too busy. Beyond that, not too interested. What I'm more interested in is college football. So talk to me about the BCS. Everybody who watches college football knows that the BCS, expletive, not good, right? Reason why, it's not fun. There's nothing competitive about it. It's pretty much... here we have Team X who's awesome. We're going to pit them against Team Y that's awesome. And everybody else, you know, gets some lesser playoff, basically.
Okay,
what do you have to say about it?
The BCS, it's interesting you want to talk about this because the BCS, which stands for Bowl Championship Series, was actually an invention of a Central Michigan former CMU football coach.
There you have it.
No way.
Yes, way.
Self-loathing, I feel it.
His name is Roy Kramer. Does that name ring a bell?
No.
Okay, well, Roy Kramer used to be the football coach here at Central Michigan a long time ago. And then he, I believe, became, this is off the top of my head, but I think he became the athletics director at Vanderbilt University. I could be wrong about that, in Nashville. But in any event, he was the commissioner of the Southeastern Conference for a period of time, Roy Kramer. And he came up with this idea because the NCAA for about 10 years couldn't make up its mind how it wanted to have a postseason sort of championship. You know, in the sport of football, that is the only sport in the NCAA that does not have a playoff system. Okay. In other words, there's no championship system at the Division I level. Now, there is a playoff system in what I used to call 1AA, which is now called the Football Championship Series, the FCS, but the FBS, which some people refer to as 1A, they don't have a playoff system. So determining the national championship is done by voting, and is done by computers, and is done by coaches, and is done by this complex formula of strength of schedule, and who have you played, and that sort of thing. So the BCS is actually a contract between six conferences and one university. Do you know which university that is?
Off the top of my head, is it Notre Dame?
Very good. A for you, Notre Dame. The BCS has this contract, which essentially assures that schools from the six largest conferences and the University of Notre Dame, as the case may be, can compete for have the greatest likelihood of winning the national championship game, which they have a special game called the BCS National Championship Game. So there are 11 conferences overall, the Mid-American Conference, CMU, being in the MAC. They're not part of the BCS, which essentially means from the day you start the football season, CMU, in reality, has no chance of winning the national championship. None.
Even if they win every single game.
Even if they win every single game.
See, this is kind of a big deal to us football fans. I mean, as I recall, this is even part of Barack Obama's platform. Right, he was interviewed, and he's like, "Yeah, I mean, I have no say in the matter, but if I did, I would eliminate the BCS." I mean, what's with this, man? I hate it.
Well, I'm not a fan of the BCS either, and frankly, the only people I know that are fans of the BCS are employed by the schools that are in the BCS. Okay, because it goes back to this George Orwell Animal Farm. You know, all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others. I mean, why wouldn't you like it if you're continually getting all the exposure, which helps in recruiting, which you know, these bowl games pay out more than any other. Right. You don't want to give any of that up, and that's what this BCS has become. So, it's become a political issue. It's certainly become a financial issue, and it's a hot topic right now. I wish we didn't have it.
And what's often said, though, in conversations, oh, I hate the BCS, let's eliminate the BCS, etc., you'll hear NCAA officials saying things like, oh, well, that's not even us. That's a totally separate organization. We have nothing to do with the BCS. How does that work?
You know, I hear that a lot. It's funny because people I know that defend the NCAA, and I want to say I am not anti-NCAA, but I am anti some of the things that they do, okay? And when somebody tells me with a straight face that the BCS works, that the BCS is in the best interest of student athletes, even though the championship game starts right at the beginning of the winter semester, you know, there's essentially no time off for the football players, etc., I just say to myself, you know, something's just not right. Why is men's football the only sport, Division I, that has this crazy contract? And you know the answer.
Show me the money.
It's all about the money because there's too much money involved.
So in order to get rid of the BCS, we have to come up with more money?
You know, well, that's an interesting, that's a whole nother topic. Yeah, I mean, if the NCAA believed that there was a way to make as much or more money with a playoff system, they might actually go that route, you know?
But it's for education. And I'm not purposes, speaking, right? Not for profit.
I'm not speaking on their behalf here, but I'm just guessing. There's too much to lose. The big schools, the schools that get the greatest exposure, they don't want to give it up. And I think the only way that this will change, and mark my words, okay, is 2011. There are plenty of people who are seriously considering attacking the BCS from a legal point of view, which is my area, under a violation of federal antitrust laws.
Well, this is right up my alley. Do tell.
Well, antitrust laws essentially go back to one act called the Sherman Act,
right,
of 1890, which says, in summary, no contract, you cannot have a contract, combination, or conspiracy that unreasonably restrains trade. And I'm one of those people who believe that this BCS, by having a contract which in reality excludes schools like Central Michigan from ever playing for a national championship, violates federal antitrust laws.
So it creates something like a bureaucracy that can't be touched. Some sort of, we might call it like an oligopoly or something like that. An oligarchy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm in economics class. Sometimes I call it a private government or some people use the word cartel for that matter. If you're a space, 2001 A Space Odyssey fan, you might call it a monolith. I mean, we can go on and on, you know, but, essentially, I'm of the opinion that the NCAA will not change on its own. It will have to change due to some external force, which could be the federal government or the courts, for that matter.
Okay. Well, I think this is a great transition. We spent more than enough time on the BCS. If you didn't catch my point of view, I hate it. In summary, let's talk about some of the litigation history surrounding the NCAA, some of the various cases. I know you're itching to talk about this. I'm sure you have lists of hundreds of them in your head. The one that comes to mind, though, the one that stuck out in class and the one that is, you know, fresh in the memory is Andy Oliver.
Mm, really?
Yeah. This becomes very important. I know we haven't covered it that much, but at the beginning of the show, you were talking a little bit about how, you know, the importance of being an amateur, how you could have a agent for a professional sport. But once it became, I'm not sure if you talked about this or not, but let me just let the cat out of the bag.
Go ahead.
There's kind of an ongoing theme in the NCAA, correct me if I'm wrong, that when an athlete contacts an agent, that's often seen as the transition from amateur to professional. Now, they're not necessarily making money yet, but the idea is if you're talking to an agent, if you sign a contract with an agent, even worse, you are looking at becoming money-making. You're looking at becoming a professional. And the NCAA has a history of, well, I'll let you tell us.
You know, you can talk to anybody who you want. It's not illegal to talk to an agent at any time. That's sort of a common misnomer. The NCAA, though, gets involved when you have an agreement. And the NCAA rule is very clear, and it says if you ever agree, orally or in writing, to be represented by an agent, that your amateur status is permanently over. But as I said before, if the contract says, you know, but this is for the sport of baseball, well, then you can still be an amateur in football and vice versa.
Okay.
So really, the NCAA's position is it's the agreement that matters, not the pursuit or inquiry. But with the case of Andy Oliver, this is a really interesting case. It represents the best and worst of what NCAA has become, in my opinion. I believe it's Vermilion, Ohio. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Vermilion. I believe it's near Lake Erie. It might be right on the border of Lake Erie. Andy Oliver was an unbelievable high school baseball player, and he was drafted by the Minnesota Twins. This is off the top of my head. I think in the 17th round, right out of high school. And Andy Oliver was trying to decide should he take the money, so to speak, and go become a minor league baseball player. Or should he go to college? And as you know, in baseball, you can get drafted in your junior year and wait it out and then get, possibly improve his draft status.
Sure.
'Cause 17th out of high school, 17th round is, I mean, it's, you don't do backflips over that. I mean, that's good. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But if you want to give up your college pursuits, that's a whole other story. So
right.
While he was in high school trying to figure out what he wanted to do, he consulted with two lawyers who also were sports agents, who also were brothers for that matter. And they advised him, and they sort of had this, they had this friendship, an ongoing friendship, and Andy Oliver decided he's not going to go into the draft. He turned down the Twins, and he attended Oklahoma State University, OSU. Well, as things turn out, he got really good in college, and he was drafted in the second or third round by the Detroit Tigers. Now, going from 17th round to second or third round is a lot of money.
Right.
We're talking
prestige as well.
I don't want to say a million. Yeah, prestige as well. Right. Hundreds of thousands of dollars here. So he gets drafted by Oklahoma State, and the lawyer friends in Ohio basically said, okay, so you're going to use this, right? And he said, no, I'm not going to use you. I'm going to use a more powerful sports agent named Scott Boris. I'm going to go with the big guy. Well, do you think that the brothers, lawyers, agents in Ohio liked that?
No, obviously not.
No, they didn't. So they sent him a bill for $113,000 for services rendered. And they told the NCAA about it. And they essentially said, you know, Andy Oliver, you know, he didn't, we're going to try to bring him down. So the NCAA says, Andy, if you had an agreement with the Baratas brothers, that was their name, then we're going to declare you ineligible. You're not ineligible to play your this year at all. Mm-hmm. And so Andy Oliver lost his eligibility, but he didn't go down without a fight. And what he did was he filed a lawsuit in the state of Ohio alleging that the NCAA rules, which say that you cannot have lawyers as a consultant, violated his constitutional right to counsel, to have a lawyer. In other words, you got an NCAA rule that says you can't agree to have a lawyer, otherwise, or representative, otherwise you become a professional. You've crossed that
right.
Clear line of demarcation. You following?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you were just staring through me, so I was getting
confused. I'm like, wow, I'm just transfixed by the whole story.
Well, just wait till you see what happens.
God.
So Andy Oliver says, and his lawyers say, You know, my client has every right to have legal counsel, and the NCAA says, well, no, you don't, because you know the rules. You cannot agree orally in writing to have a representative. The moment you do, your eligibility is up. And a Hamilton County judge, you know Hamilton County, right? Cincinnati area, I believe.
No.
Lambasted, okay. I know it's geography class too. Lambasted the NCAA and said, you know, in this country, you can't trump the Constitution. In other words, Andy Oliver has the right to have an attorney, and he ordered a permanent injunction against the NCAA saying his eligibility is restored. Well, the next week or so, might have been the next day, they were going to have a hearing on damages. And everybody in my field was sort of twiddling their thumbs wondering, what's going to happen? Could this be the beginning of the end of the no agent rule? It's called the no agent rule, by the way. And right before they have the court hearing, Andy Oliver settles with the NCAA for $750,000 or so out of court. There's never any precedent from the Andy Oliver case whatsoever. In other words, to cut to the chase, the NCAA has a rule that says you can't have an agent. Andy Oliver fought back. He fought the law, so to speak, and he won. And because, but the twist on it is, it does, there's no precedent. There's no legal precedent because it was a settlement. It wasn't a, there's no stare decisis. You know, there's no legally binding case that that can set for other future baseball or football, basketball players.
But there's dicta.
Well,
non-binding, right?
It's not going to be one that you rely on heavily, but you got to give credit to the judge in Ohio who basically said to the NCAA, you do not trump the Constitution. Everyone is entitled to counsel, and the Baratas brothers served in that capacity as an advisor.
Okay. First of all, I'd just like to compliment you on your Latin pronunciation.
What did I say?
You don't hear stare very often.
Oh, is that people say stare?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, well, thank you. I'm well-versed in my Latin etiquette.
Very good. Next, I'd just like to point out, again, letting the cat out of the bag, so to speak.
Did you like that story, though?
Yeah, I absolutely love the
story. There's one more thing. There's always more to the story.
Okay.
Andy Oliver is in the Detroit Tigers organization, as you say, and he's going to be the starting pitcher for the Toledo Mudhens in a few weeks. So he's in the AAA. He's in AAA. The Mudhens, that's their AAA team.
I don't watch any AAA, but maybe we'll see him on the Tigers again someday.
I think that you will, actually. Okay. Left-handed pitcher. Go ahead.
I was just going to point out, this is kind of a theme in the NCAA as well, that any time, you know, a case is brought to court that looks not so great for the NCAA, the paradigm, if you will, is that the NCAA settles, that there's never, ever a settlement. Let me rephrase. There's never, ever a ruling on the matter. There's always a settlement. For untold amounts of money, you know, it just kind of goes away, kind of gets swept under the rug.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. And, you know, it's funny. I tell people, and it's pretty much common knowledge, that when there are issues that could change the whole nature of the 501c3 status of the tax-exempt organization, of whether or not the NCAA truly is an amateur organization, the NCAA has a history of settling every time. So you get no case precedent, you know? What I also tell people, though, is every once in a while, the NCAA will fight, and they usually win. And that's one thing that most people don't know, is that when you sue the NCAA, you almost always lose. But when they win, but when a plaintiff wins, they win big. And there are two cases that, if we've got time, I could tell you about.
Absolutely, go for it.
All right, there's two cases that really stand out in my mind. One went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the other went to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. That's like Oklahoma, New Mexico, Wyoming, Colorado, a few other states as well, I think Montana and Idaho. But in any event, in 1984, and I alluded to this earlier, like at the very beginning of this conversation, in 1984, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down a ruling that changed the landscape of college sports forever. And the case is known as the NCAA versus the Board of Regents. And you think, Board of Regents of who? Well, it's actually the Board of Regents of the Universities of Oklahoma and Georgia. And the idea was Georgia, Oklahoma, and other schools wanted to have more exposure at the national level. Now, we're thinking back to 1984. Now, Mr. Clagstaff, You weren't born in 1984, were you?
I was negative five.
You were negative five.
Yeah.
Okay, well, 1984 was a good year. Van Halen came out with an album that year called 1984. George Orwell had a book about
1984. Same name, right?
Correct. Anyway, the Supreme Court in 1984 said that you cannot set limits on the number of times that a school can be broadcast on television.
Okay. This is the antitrust ruling you were talking
about. Yes, this is an antitrust case. And in that because of that case, the NSA versus Board of Regents in 1984, all of a sudden you started getting regional broadcasts. So in the late 80s and in the 90s, you started getting things like Jefferson Pilot Television, Fox Sports Detroit, you know, regional cable television started to arrive, you know? And so all of a sudden, schools and conferences started selling their rights, and they were on TV instead of once a year or twice a year to five times a year, six times a year. And now, as you know, today it's pretty much every game you can watch on television, right?
Right, yeah. They're all broadcast in one form or another.
Right. So the NCAA lost that case, and that was a huge victory for the schools, and that really changed the landscape of college athletics pretty much forever. Then in 1998, another case really had an impact on the NCAA, and it's known as Law versus the NCAA, which I find somewhat comical. It's like the law versus the NCAA, right?
Right.
Well, the Law was one of the plaintiff's last names.
Right.
Okay, I think his name was Norman Law. Don't quote me on that. But the plaintiff's lawyers decided, let's choose Law as the plaintiff, you know, maybe just kind of set the tone. It's like the law. But anyway, the NCAA in the 1990s came up with what today you would think is a crazy rule. They said, for cost containment purposes, let's limit the amount that certain coaches can get paid.
This is the rec rule, right?
Yes, REC, R-E-C, Restricted Earnings Coach, the REC rule. And the idea was, you know, let's kind of level the playing field and restrict how much coaches can be paid. Not all coaches. It was actually second and third assistants, primarily in the sports of basketball and baseball. And as sort of a cost containment measure. Well, the coaches got together and filed a class action lawsuit, and the coaches won. And the coaches were able to show it did not go to the Supreme Court. It was a 10th Circuit Court of Appeals case. The case basically said that the NCAA was responsible for $22 million in damages. $22 million. Now, as you probably know from antitrust law, do you remember what happens in an antitrust case is the prevailing? I know you remember, don't you?
Damages are trebled.
Damages are trebled or tripled, because when I think of treble, I think of bass and I think of boomboxes and that sort of thing. So, right? Yeah, so damages are tripled. And so the NCAA the damages tripled automatically to almost $70 million or $66.9 million. And the NCAA was trying to decide should they appeal or not. And they finally settled the case. The point being that in the Board of Regents case, which opened up unlimited number of television broadcasts, and the restricted earnings case, which said it's an unreasonable restraint of trade to control coaches' salaries, the NCAA landscape changed forever, and that's why we have this continued arms race, as some people call it, of increasing salaries, increasing revenues, increasing exposure, and a 14-year, $10.8 billion contract, and there's no end in sight to any of this madness.
But let me just
March
point
madness.
Out. Right. But the controlling organization here is a 501c3, not-for-profit, like Ronald McDonald House organization.
Right. Toys for Tots, Ronald McDonald House, Soup Kitchen, Salvation Army, Goodwill, and then the NCAA. They're all the same under the law.
Okay. Well, just so happens we have a few more minutes to kill. So on this subject, George Orwell, Animal House, equality, all animals.
Wait a minute. Animal House?
Animal Farm.
You mean,
I'm sorry. Right.
Same difference.
Yeah, same movie.
Yeah, really. Pigs, right? Animals. I'm sorry. I just couldn't. You know.
All athletes are created equal, but some are.
But John Belushi is better because
right.
He smokes.
All fraternities.
Yeah, right.
Sorry.
Let me ask you about a few. One I wouldn't have known about but for class and possibly the Olympics. Jeremy Bloom. Talk to me about Jeremy Bloom. Let me just draw a dichotomy for you so you can talk about it with
okay.
Tom Zbikowski. Now, we have two similar situations, right?
Right.
We have an athlete who wants to be a professional in some other sport, essentially. Now, there's a lot more to it. The idea is, though, we have an athlete who wants to be a collegiate player in one sport, or a student, or an amateur, if you will, and a professional, or monetary compensation, vocational, if you will,
pay
another.
For play.
Pay yeah. for play, mm-hmm. right. Now, I'll just paint a little background. Tom Zbikowski, I think, was a football player. I think he actually still is. Doesn't he play for the Ravens?
Baltimore Ravens.
Yeah, I don't know what position he is.
Safety.
Okay, there you have it. I was going to say linebacker, but safety.
A strong safety linebacker, yeah.
Okay. He plays for the Ravens. He was a college football player who took basically a purse to box professionally. Just so happens he's a pretty ripped, you know, cut guy, and he wanted to beat some people up. So he got paid.
He's a hell of a boxer.
I think he actually boxed at Madison Square Garden.
MSG, yeah, he sure did.
And he got paid a pretty significant amount. What was it, like $25,000 for one fight or something?
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah, he won, and he was
paid. See, I was paying attention.
I know, you're a good student.
So Tom Zbikowski was a college football player, good college football player, obviously, became professional, as well as professional boxer. However, he was getting paid to box mm-hmm. while he was playing college football.
Well, let me put it to you this way. He earned prize money for boxing. Yeah.
Okay. And NCAA basically said, no problem, right?
Yeah, because he didn't have an agent and he wasn't endorsing a product. So it was open to everybody and he won and he was able to do it, yeah.
Okay, very good. And so for him, NCAA thumbs up, right?
Correct. And don't forget where he went to school.
Notre Dame.
University of Notre Dame. That's exactly right. So there's always the Notre
But that Dame. Has nothing to do with it, right?
That's a whole other subject.
Okay. Now, how about Jeremy Bloom? Yeah. Talk to me about Jeremy Bloom.
Well, real quickly, Jeremy Bloom is to this day one of those special athletes that I don't want to say once in a lifetime, but just he was a freshman All-American football player from the state of Colorado. He enrolled at the University of Colorado and was an unbelievable football player, and also, quite frankly, the number one ranked mogul skier in the United States, and he competed in the 2002 Olympic Games for the United States. And Jeremy Bloom was actually featured in a Tommy Hilfiger ad at one time, and the NCAA said, wait a minute, you can't do that. And he said, well, why not? And they said, because that's an endorsement. You cannot endorse a product. If you endorse a product, you become a...
professional.
A professional. And he said, well, wait a minute. I'm not endorsing it for football. I'm endorsing it for my Olympic skiing career, and I'm not competing in skiing in the NCAA. I play college football. And they said, well, we have a no endorsement rule for a reason, because the NCAA will not allow student athletes to endorse products. And essentially what it comes down to is that Tom Zbikowski didn't endorse a product, didn't have an agent, but was allowed to earn prize money. Jeremy Bloom could not be featured in a Tommy Hilfiger ad. He could not take endorsements for his Olympic skiing career, and he did end up representing the U.S. in the next Olympics. I think it was Turin, you know, in Italy. I don't think he medaled, though. But the NCAA said, you know, not only, he took this case to court, and the NCAA said you lose your entire eligibility to compete as a student athlete. In other words, he fought the law like Andy Oliver, but in this case, the NCAA won, and they took away his eligibility. He eventually didn't do well in the Olympics, and he was drafted in the fifth round by the Philadelphia Eagles, but I don't think he played in a regular season football game.
I'll have to check that on Wikipedia.
I don't think he did.
Everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you understand the bottom line?
Yes. Again, yes. We have a third-party organization saying, hey, you didn't follow the rules, so you're not eligible to play in any college sport ever again.
Even though the endorsement and the whole issue was related to a sport that he wasn't even competing in.
And what college did he play for again?
University of Colorado.
And you think that might have anything to do with it? That, you know, maybe Tom Zbikowski couldn't possibly.
I don't. I mean, I personally do not.
Okay.
I believe it has everything to do with the fact that Jeremy Bloom fought the NCAA, and they didn't like that.
Okay. Do we have time to cover one more set of athletes? Okay. Well, this is, you know, the one that probably closest to home. I know at least one listener is particularly interested in this. Terrell Pryor. Wrong end of the NCAA, right? I would say wrong end of the NCAA. Basically what happened in the case of Terrell Pryor, if you don't know, he played for Ohio State University, actually the Ohio State University.
Still plays.
Still plays for the Ohio State University. Incredible quarterback, one of those running, passing quarterbacks. Essentially, he was found to have traded memorabilia that he had won from playing or was gifted by playing. I'm not sure if it was jerseys or rings, whatever. He traded them for tattoo work, more or less.
Yeah.
And the NCAA said, hey, you're getting paid. Now, what they actually said was you're receiving extra benefits for
right.
playing.
Right.
But essentially, this is the mark of a professional. You're getting paid to play.
Well, he didn't get paid to play. He got paid for turning over Ohio State memorabilia in exchange for tattoos.
So, needless to say, the NCAA put down.
And it wasn't just him. It was he and four other guys.
Members of the team.
Right.
And this isn't the first time something like this has happened. But basically, the NCAA laid down the law and said, well, you've broken the rules, so you're going to miss a few games.
Five games.
Was it five? I was going to say four. Okay.
But I don't mean to interrupt, but they also said you can still play in the bowl game.
Right.
Against Arkansas, the Sugar Bowl, and they won.
Is there anything else you wanted to add to that, or is that the end of your positive?
In other words, they broke a rule. But instead of being punished at the time, they were allowed to take the punishment, carry it over to the next year, and still play in the bowl.
But he was suspended for five games.
Well, he is suspended for five. Yeah.
Okay.
Next year. It goes into effect next year.
Didn't one of the games already, isn't it down to four?
I didn't think so.
Okay, well, whatever. Not important. Cam Newton. Tell me about Cam Newton.
How much time do we have?
Enough time. Cover it.
All right, Cam Newton basically... quarterback, Heisman Trophy winner from Auburn University, unbelievable athlete, maybe the number one pick overall. His father apparently was selling his son's services to either Auburn University or Mississippi State University for $180,000. It came to light. Cam Newton said he didn't know anything about it. The issue is whether or not to suspend Cam Newton for his father's actions. The NCAA feels very comfortable in saying Cam Newton knew nothing about it. The Southeastern Conference had a rule, though, that said even if your parents are involved, that you can be suspended, but that it was a case of, quote, first impression, so they didn't suspend him either. So essentially, Cam Newton received no penalty and won the Heisman Trophy, and he wasn't directly involved, although there's a lot of discussion. Did he know what his father was doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Call me crazy, but I have a hard time believing that your dad could be making $180,000 off of selling your services to a university, and you could have absolutely no idea that it was going on. That's just me.
Especially with Twitter, MySpace, Facebook.
Yeah, right. I mean, technology age, of course. So, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I'm seeing in these cases, and maybe I'm not qualified to say, is a third-party 501c3 not-for-profit organization that kind of has a power trip. Perhaps... I think there's a little bit of golden child syndrome going on here where, you know, the good performers are favored, you know, punishment is lenient, if at all. Schools that perform well get more money. But let's not forget, this is a 501c3 organization whose primary purpose is education.
Let me just sum it up like this. A few weeks ago, right before March Madness basketball tournament, a basketball player for Baylor University lost his eligibility to play because his mother took loans, unbeknownst to him, three times from an AAU basketball coach. She paid back the loans. I think the player's name is Perry Jones, as a matter of fact. Knew nothing about it. His eligibility, over. Punished.
But Cam Newton, untouchable.
Correct. And to this day, I cannot figure out the difference between the two, other than one is Baylor and one is Auburn.
And one is the star quarterback who's quite probably going
Heisman
to be drafted.
Trophy winner.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's that private justice. It goes back to what we've said over and over. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Okay. So the NCAA, a monolithic cartel of private justice? Well, you tell me. We won't make that decision for you, but we've certainly given our listeners something to think about, I hope.
Well, I hope so. There's a lot more we could talk about, but I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, you've been listening to Dr. Adam Epstein, professor here at CMU, retired sports agent extraordinaire, who is joining us with Ethics Talk, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. We've got a couple pieces of info for you before we let you go. We have an upcoming conference.
Right. I just wanted to mention, if this is totally unrelated to sports, but there is a student conference coming up. The university's Allied for Essential Medicines is having a student conference on April 2nd and April 3rd. It's a Saturday and a Sunday. It's free, and it's at Central Michigan University. There is a website with all the information, which is UAEM, Universities Allied for Essential Medicines, .cmish.edu.
Yeah, check them out. They're super cool, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been listening to Ethics Talk on the NCAA. Have a great night.